pleased to be speaking on this topic here. Actually, some of you have heard this this discussion before, and so far I've been able to speak about this to an audience that is open to this kind of discussion. I'm waiting for the opportunity to try to do this with the Bretton Woods institutions. So, but there are three main points. One is that the rising global imbalances provided fuel to the rise of the role of finance globally, which helped determine the truly global scale of the crisis. And it's and this process of disorderly unwinding is underway through the trade collapse and massive unemployment and income losses. What this graph shows are the net financial flows that are coming from developing countries and transition economies. So there are two. You can actually add the two of them, but legally the United Nations doesn't allow us to add the transition economy numbers to the developing country numbers because they are separate categories. But if you add the two of them, they're in the same pattern, right? And they make it actually worse. But what has been happening since 1997 is that the developing countries have been providing finance net, on a net basis to the rich countries. I joined the United Nations, and all of a sudden, I found out that the unit that I joined is in charge of maintaining this data on global. And I'm looking at another at global imbalances, right? So, and what is happening is that in 2008, the crisis has happened, and the imbalances are starting to unwind, but in a very disorderly way. What does it mean disorderly? It's disorderly because it's based on losses in export in the exports of developing countries and unemployment losses in many of the developing countries. This is the first one. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more. The second, maybe I can talk a little bit about the numbers. See, what we estimate for 2009 is that if you look at the graph, at the green graph, just the developing countries, the global imbalance is around 450 billion, right? What does that number mean? Well, 700 billion is the rescue package of the Bush administration. 100 billion is the annual ODA that the DAC countries provide developing countries. So even that 500 billion, which has now declined, right, with all of the losses in employment that developing countries are facing, is five times the amount that the developed countries are providing in terms of ODA, right? And actually, it was much worse. In 2008, it was almost a trillion. If you add the transition economies plus the developing countries, it's really a trillion US, right? So the second proposition, the three propositions, and I'll try to be disciplined and just go through this set of points. The second proposition is that the global imbalance is only a symptom of the underlying inequity in resources, incomes, and capabilities in terms of gender and class within and among countries. And basic point here is that the global economy was trying to solve a problem of insufficient global demand. And the reason why you needed to solve the problem of insufficient global demand is because that is the only way in which export-oriented development strategies could be feasible, right? If you force everybody to be export-oriented, you have to worry about global demand. But if you have to figure out a way to sell those goods, right? This was solved by letting debt grow faster than production and incomes. So you let debt grow faster than production and incomes, and it's completely consistent with the story where the developing countries are flooding the global economy with their own lending, right, into the rich countries. So this is the second proposition. The third proposition is that resolving the economic cooperation dimensions of global imbalances, this is the famous global imbalances, without addressing gender inequity issues, will only restart unsustainable growth patterns. Maybe not of this type, but of another type. Trade has always been imbalanced, but unless we figure out a way to address this is a claim, right? The inequity in the global system in terms of gender and class, some other way in which this kind of imbalances somewhere else will show up, right? So what I was trying to do, it died. Well, anyway, we don't need the graph, right? What I wanted to do was to present a juxtaposition of seemingly unrelated ideas, right? To try to get this IMF macroeconomic balance thing and try to connect it to gender and inequity. And the idea of this is to try to argue that addressing these basic inequalities are important if we prefer to have an orderly unwinding of the balances. I mean, it will unwind whatever we do, right? But if you want it to be orderly, we would rather think about it in terms of addressing inequitable situation, right? And and therefore this is utopian, right? It would actually mean fundamental reforms, which many parties are calling for even now, right? But this should include reducing this gender and class inequalities. By the way, the technical design of effective stimulus is consistent with this idea, but the thing with the stimulus, it's supposed to be temporary, right? It's not supposed to be a permanent kind of response. So the argument here is a little bit different. We're saying, well, you know, let's try to do a permanent response. This happens to be consistent with the short-term ideas that we have about what kinds of stimulus packages spending would be. Okay. Well, the rise of imbalances depended heavily on recasting the development strategy into the axis of private sector-led export dependence, right? So in export markets, where the richer countries in the world? And as Jayati has mentioned, the pattern of global imbalances is the ultimate perversion of the export-oriented model of poor countries financing the global consumption of their exports that were being done in the rich countries. And it's based on the one hand on inequality among countries. According to Jomo's presentation earlier, 70% of the world inequality is due to international inequalities. But with the inequalities in income, there's a global problem of insufficient demand, which undermines the export orientation beloved by the Bretton Woods institutions. And the growth pattern in recent years is a solution to this problem of inequality. As I said, a decade of strong growth fueled by increasing debt. The idea was, of course, that rising exports would lead to increasing incomes in developing countries. But rising exports required a certain level of competitiveness. And this, in many cases, was solved by feminizing the export-oriented industries and increasing the international trade in human services, in which women also were very deeply involved. And we have already discussed in this conference the many channels in which trade competitiveness was achieved by both successful and unsuccessful globalizers, by wage repression, and the maintenance of a gender wage gap, right? Because women's wages were only supplemental and not needed for family breadwinning, right? There was also a very important advantage that women's labor tended to be more flexible, that could be brought in and out of labor markets. And finally, vulnerable situations of labor would also mean more docile labor. So income inequality across countries played a role in this kind of pattern that is now being unwound, right, without us really planning to do it. But it was not unsustainable because you really cannot sustain a situation in which the poor countries are financing their own exports. But this kind of financing provided global liquidity, which had to be intermediated. It became a problem because the global liquidity was going to the United States, and it was not being invested in more production of more goods or in innovation or in the production of real goods and services in the economy. Otherwise, the U.S. would have been selling everything to all the countries, because there was also insufficient demand inside the U.S. economy, right? Because of the gender and domestic gender and income inequalities inside the U.S. economy. And this is why there was very poor investment demand on the part of the private sector in the U.S. economy. I mean, you know, General Motors has gone bust and all that stuff, right? And most of the liquidity that was provided by the developing countries went into treasury bills, which still became a problem. They had to be lent out, right? So first it was lent to credit card debt, and then it went to housing mortgages. But before that also it was lent to dot-com ventures, right? Inside the U.S., the pattern of debt outstripping income was an unsustainable process. But of course, it provided fabulous incomes in the financial sector, which many analysts believe could have actually been lent to actual investment and production, but which were not. Right? So the world is now trying to solve this global imbalance de facto in a haphazard way. And of course, as I said many ways, the greatest cost will be borne by countries and the people who did not originate the crisis. The volume of trade will contract by 10% in 2009. And the most adversely affected will be the export industries. And in fact, most of all, developing countries whose recent growth patterns have depended heavily on trade. Commodity prices have also fallen, which means a lot of loss of income in other countries. And private investment flows have reversed, as would be normal in a recession, while the cost of capital to developing countries has increased. Basically, the export market of rich countries have disappeared, perhaps for a decade, maybe a little less, but almost for a decade. And this pattern that we are now seeing of the way it's being unwound could actually exacerbate the very imbalances and inequalities which were a sort of a solution to the global insufficient demand. And in many situations, deeper and longer lasting economic collapse in developing countries. Okay, what is the alternative? And this has been mentioned, Well, one is for developing countries to rely more on their domestic market, which requires faster growth in domestic incomes, which requires faster growth in domestic wages. It requires consumption-led growth based on rising wages instead of rising profits from the ownership of assets. It also requires a rethinking of the role of the state. First, in the immediate period, substituting for the loss of demand from the private sector. And secondly, in shaping domestic investment programs for greater productivity. Jayati has already mentioned some of these. What are the long-term reforms? Well, the long-term reforms that are needed is this is an argument, right? You don't have to accept it, but the long-term reforms that are needed is to address the imbalances in access, in powers, and responsibilities in the global economy between developed countries and developing countries, between wage earners and property owners, between those who are straddling the paid and unpaid market and those that are not. You know, just to give an example on this one, now we are allowed to stimulate the economy, right? I mean, as long as you don't have a program with the IMF. Well, there is one part of the economy where you can actually begin to easily stimulate. That's the unpaid part. It's either the state moving into it or the markets moving into it, and both are okay. But that's an immediate part, just in the same way that the New York is thinking that the stimulus can be used to fill the potholes, right? But this is, in a sense, right, this is one part where you can actually begin to think about where you can expand and where you want to direct the stimulus that can actually provide a lot of good impact, right? So greater reliance on wage growth, greater reliance on the domestic market, and finding a way to install a more sustainable growth pattern. Faster consumption in developing countries, fueled by income, not by debt creation. The reduction in unpaid labor. This is something that Nilufer and I have been trying to put into the statement here about the fact that women all over the world, whatever their income classes, right, are paying an invisible tax to the global economy as a source of trade competitiveness of all countries. I mean, because of the tax on their time, right? And therefore, you need the full costing of that time in some sort of way, right? And that's one part where you can expand. The greater role of the state and the market in activities that are currently unpaid. Two more utopian remarks, right? This one is also to reverse the hierarchy of finance over production, and in turn, production over reproduction. So put reproduction first, and human needs first, right? And this is how, you know, you might like to organize your economies, right? And the last utopian remark is that both trade and finance should serve human needs and human development. I mean, the reason why this is utopian is, what if you have a situation where both trade and finance policies for every country was based on the idea of full employment or near full employment in each country, right? Right now, it's not based on that, right? The reason why it's not based on that is because it's based on countries competing with each other, right? For that market that is in the developed countries, right? So, why not change trade and financial policies so that they are molded in the context of full employment in each country or near full employment in each country? That's what I wanted to say in this outline.